Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
On today's podcast, I'm excited to welcome Danielle Pruitt back to On the Wing. Danielle is a member of the Meat Eater crew and a longtime friend of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. In fact, she spoke at a number of different National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classics and has contributed to both the Pheasants Forever Journal and the Quail Forever Journal, including the brand new issue of QFJ. Joining me today is Quail Forever Journal editor, punching his frequent podcasting card, Ryan Sparks, our Quail Forever editor. And it was his concept that resulted in us bringing Danielle back to the Quail Forever Journal. Additionally, we're going to talk to Danielle about her brand new book titled Meat Eaters Wild and Whole Cookbook Seasonal Recipes for the Conscious Cook. So thank you both for joining. Ryan, you're running co-host. Thanks for coming back.
You got it.
And I would be remiss, Danielle, if I didn't first congratulate you on becoming a new first-time mom.
Thank you.
How you feeling?
Tired.
How far are we into being a mom at this moment in time? How many days?
9 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. So he was born July 3rd, almost a 4th of July baby. And I mean, it's been pretty incredible. Everything everybody has always said, that the best and hardest thing you've ever done. I'm already feeling that at 9 weeks in. But it's been pretty surreal. You know, my husband and I, Travis, who I'm sure I'll bring up quite a bit in this podcast. We've been together now for like 12 years. And I remember telling somebody once, like when I was pregnant, that we were celebrating our 12th anniversary, and he about spit his drink out, and he was like, "You're just now having kids." And I laugh because, you know, it's always been the two of us on a lot of adventures, and hunting and fishing have been a really central part of our lives. And so now to have a third party in the mix, to pass this love down to somebody else, it's really kind of an interesting thing that we're kind of a new adventure we're embarking on.
What's the most surprising aspect that you just never would have anticipated about being a mom?
You know, I thought that I would be, you know, everyone says like, accept the help. You know, and I thought that, oh, it would be really easy to do. And I never expected to like have like the strong emotional mama bear reaction to like not wanting anybody to help. Not that they can't help, like come over and help, but not, I don't know, just like a very protective sense. And maybe because he's so new, he hasn't had all like vaccines or anything yet. So maybe that probably plays into it. But I think the intense like motherly feel, I wasn't really expecting that. I thought that was something that you just developed over time, and I didn't realize that it would just sort of sink in naturally right away.
And what's your youngster's name?
Hank.
Yeah. Is there a story behind the name? Any family traditions?
Yeah.
There?
So my mom's maiden name, her name was Denise Hanks. Hanks was her maiden name. She passed away when I was younger. And so it's a way to honor her.
That's yep. Very cool. This may be the last time we do a podcast without video, because as we record this, Danielle is in her nursery and there is a mountain lion taxidermized above your shoulder, which is somewhat incongruent to what I was expecting.
Yeah,
for a darting baby.
I know. Travis told, there's a collection of odd end bits on that table of everyone's like, what's the nursery theme? And I'm like, we don't really have a theme. It's just a collection of stuff. I don't know. My husband said you can decorate it however you want, but the cat has to go in the room. And so that's Pearl. He shot her in North Dakota.
Okay.
A whole interesting story that we don't need to get into, but that's Pearl.
Is it a mountain lion or is it a bobcat?
It's a mountain lion.
It is a mountain lion. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's because I didn't want her in the living room. And so we're running. We don't have a lot of spots to put it. And so it's in this room.
Well,
he doesn't
wonderful.
Know the difference.
For folks that maybe don't know your backstory, and like I mentioned, you've been on the podcast with us a couple times before, but give us a little bit of, you know, where you grew up and kind of your journey up to the point of working for Meat Eater.
Yeah, so I grew up, born and raised in Texas, North Texas. Although my husband, if you're from Texas, he makes fun of me because I'm so close to the Red River that I should be in Oklahoma, and it really gets under my skin. No offense to Oklahoma. I think there's probably some sort of banter between Texas and Oklahoma right there at the border that there is for South Dakota and North Dakota.
The Red River rivalry.
Yeah. So I'm born and raised in Texas. My family's actually from South Dakota, and I spent a lot of time going there every year for holidays. And, you know, I met Travis in college in West Texas at Texas Tech, and we got married. And shortly after, he whisked me away to North Dakota, where we spent some time there, and I just absolutely fell in love with the place. Did not expect to like it at all, but I did, and I miss it all the time and wish I could move back. But it was there that really life took a major change for me as far as my career and what I do. I work for Meat Eater as, oh gosh, I don't really know what my formal title is, but essentially a content creator within the wild food space. So I basically get to travel around and hunt and teach people how to cook, mostly at home cooking. And I think that's something that I never dreamed could be a real job, because I loved food and I loved cooking, but I didn't want to work in a restaurant because of for a lot of reasons, hours being one of them. But I wanted to be able to help people at home appreciate wild food the way that I appreciated it, because we work so hard to get it. And I think everybody should enjoy that and have that respect for the animal. And so that's really what I set out to do. And I really didn't mean to make a career out of it. I started as a blogger, and I think I kept it secret for a long time until I think it was North Dakota Game and Fish. I don't know how they found out about me, but they somehow found out about me. And then somebody at Pheasants Forever read an article about me in the Game and Fish article or Game and Fish magazine, which I'm just going to tell everybody right now, I'm running on very little sleep, so the words just don't come out of my mouth as easily as they should. So if I repeat myself or talk in circles, I'm really, really sorry.
You're doing great. You're doing awesome.
Anyway, and so Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever had me at one of the Sioux Falls National Pheasant Fest events that I cooked at. And that was really kind of probably my entry into the outdoor space, outdoor, I don't know what you call the hunting industry. And so it was really sort of the kickoff moment. I met Steve Rinella there. If you remember, he was the keynote speaker.
Yep.
I don't remember what year that was.
I think it was 2018. Does that sound right?
It seems like yesterday to me. It feels like yesterday, but yeah, so we had somehow got connected through email, and he's like, invited me to breakfast with Giannis Poutelis and Doug Duren. And so had breakfast, talked about work, and asked me to come along for the ride of Meat Eater becoming Meat Eater Inc. as we know it today. And it was really, really cool because I kind of sat in on a room of a handful of people as we talked about the company and the growth and what the vision was for Meat Eater and how it would grow, and have been on that journey for, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years now. And so it's really amazing to see how the company has expanded and taken on a whole new life form practically. And to still be a part of it and still have my little corner, of just cooking, and it's been so much fun.
Yeah, I think it's more than a little corner. Your content is fabulous.
Thank you.
I follow along everything you do on Instagram. You know, what you say is home cooking and connecting the hunt with the habitat, with what you put on the plate is everything that, you know, I have the same ideology. So many of our members do, you know, I know Ryan does as well. That's kind of the concept that he's trying to bring forward in print, and what you do is wonderful. So thank you for connecting those dots for people, particularly including the habitat.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When I started blogging, it came from a place of, one, I wanted to eat more sustainably, and I didn't really know how. And so hunting was a very easy and natural way to do that because I married a hardcore hunter, and it just made a lot of sense to me. But I also just really knew that I wanted to cook really great food, and wild food tasted so much better to me than domestic, and I would choose it any day. And so I never expected to be a conservationist or to think about conservation. I just wanted to cook good food. And through this process, you know, my mind completely changed into what conservation means and to how food can be more than just a meal that provides sustenance, fills your stomach, tastes good. It can have a lot of meaning and can carry a lot of weight in your life for how you want to live in a more thoughtful way.
You've teed up Ryan perfectly. So yeah, I'm gonna pass the microphone to Ryan to talk about his vision for the Hunter's Table. In just a moment, before I go there, I want to thank Onyx, is a supporter of this podcast, and Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Wildlife Habitat Mission. If you check out the Onyx link in the show notes for this episode, you can click on that link. It'll take you to a page to subscribe to Onyx, and if you use the code PFQF, you'll get 20% off your purchase, and Onyx will make a donation from your purchase back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Wildlife Habitat Mission. So thank you very much to Onyx, and thanks to all the folks out there. Now is a perfect time to, you know, renew your membership or get a new membership to Onyx. All right, Ryan, Danielle couldn't have teed you up any better to talk about your vision. You've been in this role for, well, coming up on a year. It's probably been about 9-10 months at this point. But one of the things that was real important to you was this idea of the Hunter's Table being part of Quail Forever Journal. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, really. I mean, Danielle took a lot of the words out of my mouth for what I wanted that column to become. A lot of times, you know, it's one thing to have a recipe, and good. I do love a good recipe, but I think a lot of times, especially in print, it's that story behind the recipe and the deeper meaning it has and that connection to the land and conservation and all the things that we all love so much that you can really, it's a story on a plate. And, you know, her article, which I should say is an excerpt from her book, is just every meal has a story to tell. And it's just as a I'll let Danielle describe it, but it just does such a fantastic job of encapsulating everything that I wanted that column to be. Yeah, just did a fantastic job. So thank you for that.
Thank you. That was a really special story for me. And I think, you know, I say that all the time. Every meal has a story to tell. And I think, you know, what I wrote a lot about in my cookbook and a lot of what I talk about on social media is getting people interested to find those stories, because I think at a surface level, you know, we can get really wrapped up in sort of the minutia of game and hunting and fishing and trophies and, you know, some of that kind of stuff. And then when you really start to sort of dig a little deeper into those stories and where that animal came from on that landscape, and more importantly, how that landscape has evolved and changed over several hundred years, it really takes on a greater meaning, and kind of changes your perspective for like what you want the future outcome to be, for future generations who do want to hunt, as a conservationist.
You talked about, as we were kind of the previous segment, about your love for North Dakota, mm-hmm. and your desire to move back there. What in that landscape tugs at your heartstrings to move back?
Well, it wasn't winter. it wasn't ice fishing. I hate ice fishing. I'm sorry if you love it, anybody. I hate it. I had one really bad experience.
what was the bad experience?
This is one of the stories that I wrote about in my cookbook, because the whole sort of point of this book is to eat consciously and find those stories. I wanted every recipe to have a story, mm-hmm. Have something behind it. And so I had a recipe for a fish stew that I created while living in North Dakota. I talk about the worst fishing trip I've ever been on was Devil's Lake fishing tournament. It's like the fireman station. I don't remember exactly what it's called. But there's no houses. It's only 2 hours long. There's no houses allowed. And I had never been ice fishing before. And I show up just like, you know, with a few things and immediately look down and the hole's already frozen over. And I'm like, wait, how do we go fishing? And I look over and everyone's got an axe and they're chipping in their holes and they've got their little coffee can with a candle in it and dripping the water. And I'm just like, this is messed up. Wants to do this. And I think the wind was howling at a good 35, 40 mile an hour. And I don't remember what the actual temperature was, but with the wind chill, I know that it was well in the negatives. And it was miserable. I made it about an hour and a half in, didn't catch a fish, but I swore off ice fishing forever. but other people caught fish and gave me fish, and all I wanted was a really hearty stew with that fish instead of a fish fry that you would normally have, which is great, like on a summer day, but on a cold winter day, I really wanted soup. So anyway.
was it a pike or walleye or perch? What was in the stew?
The stew, I made it with walleye. Okay. And so it's really tricky because I based it off of a San Francisco Italian Cioppino stew, mm-hmm. which is kind of like, you know, sort of a hodgepodge of seafood that sort of was traditionally collected at the docks. And so it could have shellfish in there. And usually they'll use a heartier piece of fish, like a firmer texture fish, mm-hmm. so it doesn't fall apart. And so with this stew, because walleye is so delicate, you kind of make the whole stew and everything all together. There's like tomatoes and stuff in it. And then you just gently put the walleye in at the very end, just to barely poach it and serve it. And it's really, really nice that way. So you don't hardly have to cook it.
Well, it sounds wonderful. It, you know, obviously with so many of our listeners being from the North Woods, North Country, mm-hmm. I'm sure There'll be people buying your cookbook just to get the the ice fishing ice fishing stew. Well, I'll circle back to the original question before I took you down the ice fishing memory lane, which is what you fell in love with about North Dakota. And what I'm thinking about is, you know, probably there's a connection there to your South Dakota roots as well.
Yeah.
And what you might be, you know, what in that landscape tugs at your heart?
The grasslands and the western part of the state. We lived in Dickinson, and so we were only 30 minutes out towards Teddy Roosevelt National Park. Mm. And so, you know, you've got grasslands sort of wedged, you know, right under the park, right in between, and then right above, and then, you know, kind of also scattered all over the place. But that sort of little section, that corridor west of Belfield is the area that I love to hunt. And I remember, like, the first time going out there, actually, the first time we went grouse hunting out there, we were just driving on some Scoria Road, and I had never seen neither Travis or I had ever seen a sharp-tailed grouse. And so, you know, there's one thing of, like, make sure we're identifying the right bird here. I don't know how many birds could possibly look like a sharp-tailed grouse out here, but if you've never seen them before and you've never hunted them before, like, we didn't know what to expect. And the dadgum things were walking across the road. And I thought, well, this is easy. We got out of the car. We saw them go into some brush a little ways away. And then we had got the dog out and just walked over. And I mean, we shot our limit. And we were like, well, this is the easiest thing ever. And I swear that was a curse, because it's never, ever, ever been that easy ever again. Mm. But yeah, spending time out there, there's just something, I just don't know how to describe it, but it's just the most beautiful place I've been to. And that's coming from someone who's been fortunate to do a lot of big game hunting in Colorado, Utah, Montana, all of those places. I would pick North Dakota any day. And I think it's something to do with, like, the understatement. You know, there's not giant mountains or anything. I think the Badlands itself are really beautifully carved out, but there's something about, I think, the expanse of the landscape and being able to see, you know, getting up on a little butte or a little hill and just being able to look out beyond and kind of feeling that feeling of what it might have looked like hundreds and hundreds of years ago before we stepped foot and messed everything up. I mean, you still got the two tracks from the oil field going through the heart of it, which is kind of a love hate because my husband's in the oil industry, but, you know, without some of those roads, I would have never been able to go to the places that I wanted to get to. But other than that, you know, you kind of get this little glimmer of what something might look like untouched land. And I think for me, the sharp-tailed grouse just are such an incredibly resilient bird that I have a lot of respect for. You know, I do a lot of pheasant hunting. I think it's a ton of fun to do with friends in more agricultural areas. But sharp-tailed, I think, are just different because they're just so hardy, you know, just when you're out there in the most brutal of weather and to know that they're just surviving as they always have for whoever knows how long without our interference to help them out with crops, you know, it's just a really amazing, amazing thing. And I think Teddy Roosevelt said it himself, said it best himself when he said, "It was here that the romance of my life began." It was written in one of his books. And so I've always kind of held on to that quote. And North Dakota is a special place for me.
That's beautifully told.
You wrote about your first solo trip for sharptails in the article for Quail Forever Journal. Can you just talk a little bit about that? Obviously, you did a great job writing about it, but I think the people
I kind of fell in love with the place, and then life took a change, and Travis and I moved back to Texas. And I remember that first fall, I was like, oh no, I'm, you know, how are we going to upland hunt? Like, I missed North Dakota so much that I wanted to go back and hunt again. And in those, from the time we were only there for a 5-year span, and I talk like I've lived in North Dakota my entire life, but it was really only 5 years, a really great 5 years. But at the end of that time, I would take off and go hunting by myself, with Z, and we'd go out into the Badlands for just little quick day trips. And I was never super successful, but I always loved to just like have a reason to sneak out and go for a hike with the dog. If I got something, great. But when we moved back to Texas, I immediately kind of felt this void and I was just really missing it. And so I was like, Travis, I got to go back up there and hunt. And he was like, yeah, I want to hunt here. I want to do that. You know, and we kind of talked about our hunting plans that year and what we were going to do now that we were back in Texas. And I was like, well, you know what? I'm going. You can come or not come, but I'm going. And so I kind of hatched together a plan. And so it was the first time that I've taken like a big cross-country road trip to hunt alone. And so I loaded up the car, took Z with me. And first we stopped in Nebraska and I hunted in the sand hills for a few days.
Cool.
You know, it was so much fun because I did a little scouting on Onyx, but really I just kind of just went into uncharted territory. And I just expected the grouse habitat and behavior to be just like they were in North Dakota, and they wasn't. And so I thought that was really interesting to like think that you know how to hunt one bird, mm-hmm. and then you see them in a different location and their behavior is different. I mean, they're the same in a lot of ways, but they ran on me like a blue grouse, and I was pissed. anyway, so I spent a couple days in Nebraska, and then I went up into North Dakota after that. And so I spent a couple days there, and I'd gone to some areas where I was familiar with, so I didn't feel, you know, lost or scared or anything. But it did get very, very cold and I was alone and I felt up to that point. I think I was 3 or 4 days in. I can't remember. I hadn't even seen a bird. And so, well, I had seen a couple birds, but they were not in walking distance for me or Z. And so we were just getting really frustrated and I just kind of felt really stupid because I was like, why did I drive all the way? This is my vacation. I drove all the way out here in the middle of nowhere by myself. And then everyone's like, how many birds are you shooting? And I'm like, well, but really, one of the major reasons for wanting to do this trip, wasn't so much about filling a bird bag. It was really more that I wanted to have a bond with my bird dog that I had always seen Travis and Zisu have. And I always make a joke that when you hunt with somebody else's dog, it's very much like being the third wheel on a date, you know, like, you know, that dog is not working for you. They're working for their handler. The dog's going to work hard. He doesn't care who's really shooting the bird as long as you shoot it. He's going to work for you, but like I would be so jealous when we'd be in the field and we'd be walking and Z's doing his thing, zigzagging. And if Travis wouldn't have to say a word, if he didn't want to go that direction, he'd change his body language change and Z would look back and change with him. And it was like those two were in a rhythm and I was just like following along. I hated that feeling. So I wanted to be able to have that one-on-one time with my dog and to create that bond. And so that was probably one of the highlights of my trip. But a few days in, feeling pretty defeated, it got very cold, very miserable. And I was in the back of the car. I had a hole in my tent and it was like dumping snow. And so we were like all bundled up trying to stay warm. And, you know, the sun came out the next day and Zeus's tail was in my sleeping bag wagging 1,000 miles an hour. And their energy is so contagious. You can't help but just say, all right, Z, today is the day. Let's get up. Let's do it again. Because we put a lot of miles on each day. And then that day was, it was such a great day. The sun came out. You know, I think those, the snow had, kept those birds tucked in pretty tight. And we finally came upon a nice little grove of buffalo berries, and there they were just sort of chilling. And it was just like the perfect opportunity where they actually, well, some birds jumped, but there's always a few that stay behind. And of course those were the ones that I was able to shoot. And so, you know, it was just kind of a nice moment where everything kind of worked out the way that you hope it works out. And so I think really for me, that hunt was less about the birds and, you know, filling a limit or any of those things that, you know, people get excited about hunting. But for me, the memory, the significance of that hunt, I think, laid a lot into being able to sort of spend time on the landscape, find that appreciation for it, and really sort of discover the beauty of the grasslands and the importance of the grasslands. It sort of bridged the gap to me from hunting for sustenance to conservation. And it became, the grasslands sort of just became this like really important thing in my life that I just suddenly cared so much more about because of that bird.
You absolutely cannot tell that you're sleep deprived. That was that honestly, that was beautifully told.
Thank you.
It was wonderfully written in the Quail Forever Journal, but that was beautifully told, Danielle.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I think every hunter has that moment when, you know, upland hunting, a lot of times it's a social thing and you're going with other people. And I think about myself, like growing up and going hunting with my dad and my grandparents, but everybody has that moment when they go and they do it by themselves for the first time with their dog. And it's like that feeling of like, okay, I can do this. Like I can, and like, it's just such a affirming and powerful thing. And it's funny that the places that those happen, you often like form a really close relationship with those type of landscapes because those memories are formed in those places and you just associate those feelings with that same landscape. And so it's it was cool to hear you tell it.
Yeah, and I have to say, maybe I'm just an introvert at heart, but I really love hunting alone. I don't know why. Maybe it's just because it offers sort of the peace and quiet and stillness that you're looking for at the right moment. But there's something about it that's special.
I couldn't agree more. I given the choice, I would hunt alone. No offense to any friends or family, but just there's something that's pure joy. Being with your dog or dogs on in a place that you love, and you just you have a moment to think in this busy world, and that moment to think and just relax and just find joy. I mean, it's so rare, and I definitely find it when I'm alone on a hunt with just my dogs in a place I love. Out of that story, in conjunction with the story in our journal, came a special recipe. Tell us about that recipe.
Yeah, so, you know, I want every recipe I make to have a story. And so, you know, those birds were in a buffalo berry bush. And so I got the smart idea to grab a whole bunch of berries and put it in my bag. And those berries are super tart, if you've ever decided to eat one. They're very small little red berries, and because not a lot of people have access to buffalo berries, and also because while I was smart enough to put them in my bird bag, I was not smart enough to take them out of my bird bag. And I remember getting home from the trip and smelling this like terrible rotten smell, and I was like, did I like have bird guts and you're like, what is that? And I was like, oh, the berries. So I wanted to create a recipe that sort of went back to those berries. And so what I did was incorporate raspberries. And so this recipe is part of a winter chapter where raspberries are not naturally growing in the winter, producing fruit in the winter. However, when you freeze a raspberry and defrost it, you know, they start to fall apart and you get those in little individual, little, I forgot what you call that in berries, the little fragment, little round balls.
The little nodes of the berry.
Yeah, there is a term for it that escapes me right now. But and then you get all the juices and everything. And I just knew that would make really the perfect sauce. Because sharp-tailed grouse should actually be treated more like beef or duck, which I think is a really hard concept. Because most people say, okay, it's a bird, it's poultry, cook it all the way through. And that's not the case. They're a darker red meat. You want it to be, you know, medium rare to medium, or rare if you're just like that kind of person. I think a medium rare to medium is a great, great temperature doneness to aim for. And then those berries make up a sauce that's very vibrant and bright and acidic. And I think it really kind of cuts through the richness of sharp-tailed grouse. And so many people hate that bird and the way that it tastes, and it's either because they've overcooked it or maybe they're just not pairing it the right way, because it is a richer, fuller flavor, robust, if you will. And so I think that sauce really pairs really nicely with it.
Yeah, and it's beautiful. And if Ryan, you redid this recipe, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so I cooked the recipe for one, because I wanted to try it, and two, shoot some extra photos for the journal. And yeah, both me and my wife thought it was great. And another nice thing about it is really it's not like a chef-y recipe. It's a recipe that is just like, you can taste the grouse, you can taste the raspberry sauce. They go really well together, and mm-hmm. it's not like out of the question to like whip it up on a weeknight either. It turned out really great.
Yeah. Yeah. I think people, if they're lacking confidence in the kitchen, they hear the word sauce and they think, oh gosh, I got some sort of French thing I got to do. But really, it couldn't be any easier. After searing the meat, you know, you just add some liquids and some frozen raspberries to the pan and then swirl in some butter and you're done. Yep. It's really easy. It's a go-to. It's great with duck too.
Yeah. I bet the whole thing comes together in 20 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And as this episode airs, sharptail season is open and pretty much everywhere. So it's a perfect recipe.
Great.
To put to work. All right. So next we're going to talk about the cookbook. We've been teasing this all the way along. Before we go there, I want to give another shout out to Grain Belt Premium, the official pheasant friendly beer. That's right. Brand new this month. Grain Belt Premium and Premium Light features the Pheasants Forever logo on the cans and bottles and cases. Grain Belt is available in Minnesota and all the surrounding states beginning middle of this month of September. So it should be available in liquor stores near you. Good land, good beer. In today's premium moment from the field, comes to us via Twitter from an account called Old Satori Bird Dogs in Drift Boats. And I picked this one. I couldn't find, I think Z is a griff, if I recall correctly, Danielle. Is that right? Is Z a griff?
Well, he's a Deutsch Drahthaarf.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. So this is close.
Not,
my apologies.
Not to get political.
Yeah. So not a griff. This is a story about a German wire-haired pointer. So a relative to Z, not mm-hmm. the exact. But so Old Satori writes in via X that I got my first bird dog named Buster. And Buster pointed his first covey of birds at 10 months old, and he was a wonderful wire hair ever after. He's the first dog I ever owned. He is everything I ever dreamed of. And this is a memorial tribute to Buster. Buster lived from 2004 to 2014, and he gave me everything I had, and he is my best bird dog I've ever owned. So I just love that story about Buster from Old Satori via Twitter. So thank you for sending that in via Twitter. You have a Grain Belt Premium prize pack headed your way, thanks to Grain Belt Premium, the pheasant-friendly beer. All right, we talked about some of the stories in your book, a couple of the recipes, including a great ice fishing story and recipe. Tell us about the inspiration for the cookbook. What led you to take this leap? Because that's a pretty big project.
It was huge undertaking. It took me over 3 years, about 3 years to write it and a year for production, or 2.5 years to write. I don't know how long it took. It took a long time. And so when I was approached by actually a couple different publishers reached out and asked if I wanted to write a cookbook, and I was like, yeah, I don't know. And then enough came to me that I got in touch with an agency and sort of started to work on a proposal. And when I really started thinking about what was missing in the world of cookbooks for hunting and fishing, and every single book is just about game. And for me, you know, Wild and Whole, as it originally began, was about everything on the plate, not just the meat that I was eating, but about everything else. Because it started as a project of wanting to eat consciously. And so the protein was a big part of it, but also the vegetables that were growing and things that you could forage, all that was really important to me. And there really isn't a cookbook out there where you're going to find side dishes or even a, you know, desserts or and all the things, because to me, I wanted a cookbook that reflected the lifestyle that I live of sort of getting outdoors in nature and acquiring food and being excited about the food that comes into each season. And so I decided that I would write a seasonal cookbook, meaning that it's organized by spring, summer, fall, and winter instead of venison, turkey or whatever. So I decided that was the way I was going to organize it because, you know, my husband and I are opportunistic hunters and we hunt and fish pretty much year round. And so every season there's something to look forward to. And so I wanted, you know, people to open up spring chapter and see turkeys and get very excited about what they could make with turkey, to see morels, to see fresh asparagus, like things that are growing in your garden. Like for me, it's like radishes. I love having fresh lettuce and radish in my garden. And so like, I wanted to really find a way to encapsulate the seasons as they come and in a really beautiful way, sort of as told through, you know, my life through the season and the journeys that I go on. You know, in the summer, where we spend our time close to the water. And then in the fall, we're spending our time out in the field. And in the winter, it's the migration. You know, there's always something there. And it's really kind of about embracing food in the present moment and enjoying that. And so that's kind of what the cookbook is, how it's organized, at least.
It's fascinating. When does it hit the market? Because as we talk about this, it's pre-orders right now, right?
Yes. So it's available for pre-order, and it is out wherever books are sold October 8th.
Okay. Well, our timing's going to be perfect because this episode's going to release towards the end of September.
So okay, great.
Yeah. Right in front of people's ability to get their cookbook and stories that go along with it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories. Go ahead.
Does every recipe have an accompanying story to it?
Probably every wild game for sure. Some of the vegetables in the gardening have like a gardening fail story or something. But not everything is like... Not everything has like a really deep story. Some of them are just kind of stories of in the kitchen of experimenting and finding things. But there is a backstory to everything. And it's what made my cookbook very long. And my editors made me, I mean, I wrote so much, especially in the front matter chapters. There's a chapter about eating consciously, and what that means to me, because it is sort of the foundation of this book and why I do what I do. And then there's a chapter about how to work with wild game, for people who've never really spent a lot of time either processing wild game or aren't familiar with species that are available to hunt and eat. And so there's those two front matter chapters got really heavy. And I think my editor told me to write 70,000 words and I wrote 90. And so we spent a few months just trying to edit it all down because they had to stop and remind me, Danielle, this is a cookbook, not a novel. Because there was so much about, I mean, because, you know, there's so many cookbooks out there. It's just like a recipe is a recipe because it tastes good. And to me, a recipe is so much more than that because of where the food comes from. And so it was very hard to minimize it.
Is there, you know, with some books, some cookbooks, there's tours and events, you know, but you're a brand new mom too. Do you have travel coming up? Do you have events or is that not even possible being a brand new mom?
I had a few opportunities come up and I have unfortunately had to decline. You know, it's hard. This cookbook was my baby and I spent years working on it. And it's so funny how we were sort of kind of getting to the finish line. And I was like, well, I'm pregnant and I'm having my baby right when the book is due. And it just kind of, you know, changed everything, changed the plans a bit. And so I'm sad that there's some events that I'm not going to be able to do. But at the same time, I don't know. I think I worked so hard on this book and I feel like I have all 70,000 words memorized that I'm like also a little sick of it. So I'm like ready for the real, now I want to spend time with my real baby. But it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. That's a massive achievement and, you know, 3 years in the making. And, you know, if the samples that are in the current edition of Quail Forever Journal, both the story and the recipe, are any indication of how the cookbook is going to be, folks should go out and order it right away. It's wonderful. And obviously, you know, your connection to conservation and to our organization is just another reason that our members should listen. And, you know, please take the time to go find, I'm assuming you can find a link on Meat Eater to pre-order the book, Google.
It's well, I say this as of today, by the time you hear it won't matter, but like Barnes & Noble is carrying it. And if you're a Barnes & Noble member, you get like 25% off pre-orders, which, so they've run that deal twice now. And so maybe they'll run it again by the time this podcast comes out. But so you can get it, you know, you can order it through the Meat Eater website, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I know some local bookstores are carrying it, but yeah.
So we'll get to the final question, but I've got a second to final question that I ask. I think I've asked every wild game chef we've ever had on, most recently Yia Vang, and it's remarkable how consistent the answer is.
Uh-oh, what if I'm not?
Well, it's fine. It's okay for you to be different, but I'm just curious. Your absolute top of the list favorite wild game meat to eat.
I get asked all the time.
And I guess it might be different based on kind of your love affair with North Dakota, but I am curious. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it matches up with everybody else.
I always say it's whatever game I haven't had in the longest amount of time, because I'll go through phases where if my husband shoots an elk, we're eating a lot of elk for a long time. We went to North Dakota last year and had just a great waterfowl season. So we ate a lot of waterfowl for a long time. And then you go through these phases of like, and then all of a sudden it's been a couple of years and I'm like, I haven't had a Hungarian partridge in a really long time. That's the thing that I crave and miss. But if you were, I mean, I would say which I will say Hungarian Partridge is up there. It's not the top, but it's up there as a very underappreciated game bird. I think it's better than pheasant, quail. I think it's kind of that perfect meat where it's not as, you know, pale and white as a pheasant, but it's not as dark as grouse or dove. It's, you know, it has a little blush to it. And mm-hmm. if you cook it just right, it's just really full of flavor and tender and juicy. I really like antelope, but I have to say a very juicy, fat mallard is probably my favorite. Is that what does everybody else say?
So surprisingly, or at least to me, a very consistent answer is squirrel.
Really?
Where a lot of chefs will say, you know, you are what you eat, and squirrel eat nuts, and they're buttery and robust, and quite a few folks historically
That's
just
funny.
Go to squirrel.
And we eat to a me, lot of squirrel.
You do eat a lot of squirrel?
Yeah, so our house where we live at now, we have like 3 acres, and it's just covered in trees, and they tear into my garden, and I get real pissed. So we have garden revenge, and then we have the fall. The acorns are everywhere, and the squirrels are everywhere. And, yeah, so well, they drive Zisu crazy, just crazy. He'll stare out the window. Like, you can see his beard is always wet and matted, and you'll see stains across the bottom of all the windows of our house where he's been watching squirrels. And so it's a good day for him when we shoot a couple.
All right. Before I go to the final thought, Ryan, did I miss anything along the way that you wanted to ask Danielle?
No. And I'm with you on the duck. I think I always say if I have a prison meal, if they're going to execute me tomorrow, I think duck and oysters would be on the menu for sure. Yeah.
You have a refined palate.
Yeah. I like squirrels too, if that's refined.
Well, he did say that, he defined it as a prison meal. We don't know what got him into prison. All right. Final question. You can go on a hunt anywhere for any bird with anyone, followed by a meal at the end. Tell us what you're going to do, Danielle.
Oh, gosh. Well, I feel like the answer I would say is probably sharp-tailed grouse. But for the sake of talking about something else, it's definitely a bird. Wait, did you say is it a bird or did you say any game animal?
I said bird.
Oh,
we're
okay.
Pheasants
well,
forever and quail forever, so we're going to go birds.
I mean, I would pick a bird anyway. I don't know. You know, I think it might be something I've never hunted before for the experience of something new and for trying and eating something new. I always crave those moments. I've never hunted ptarmigan. I think I would love to go into Colorado right about now is about the time people start making their trek up there. I just sort of like the aspect of a hunt that involves adventure, needing to get in shape. I like having a reason to work out over the summer. And then, of course, to try something new, have something challenging, be outside, sort of in the elements, and at the end, try something new.
That's a wonderful answer. I'm right there with you. That sounds terrific. New place, new taste, new experience.
Yeah.
Well, Danielle, thank you very much for spending time with us. Most importantly, congratulations on both the book and on the new becoming a new mom.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on. It's always so much fun to talk to you guys. I never get to talk about bird hunting quite enough, so this is great.
Well, really appreciate it, and really appreciate the connection you have to our organizations and to our Grassland Habitat mission. It's really meaningful to us to have you so passionate about what we care about so deeply.
Absolutely. I love what you guys do.
Well, thank you. The fall edition of the Quail Forever Journal has the story and the recipe we've been talking about throughout this episode. The winter edition of the Pheasants Forever Journal has a pheasant recipe from Danielle. If you are not a member of either organization, sign up online, email me, bobs@pheasantsforever.org, and I'll take care of getting you both issues. Most importantly, Google, Amazon, Meat Eater, Barnes & Noble, get Danielle Pruitt's book. It's recipes, it's stories. Pruitt is spelled P-R-E-W-E-T-T, and you can't miss it. For Danielle Pruitt, for Ryan Sparks, I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.